Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I'm a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for science, careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, the focus is on fungi. And as is so often the case, we have one of the world's experts right here in the Triangle. Dr. Cedric Pierce is the founder and CEO of a biotechnology company called Mycosynthetics, which markets both Dr. Pierce's and his colleagues' considerable expertise in fungi, and a library of more than 55,000 species of fungi, which is used for lead compound development of pharmaceuticals and agricultural products. This is all part of the area of biochemistry known as natural products development, which we featured here on Radio In Vivo previously, and which has a rich history here in the Triangle, including the discovery and development of two milestone anti-cancer drugs, Taxol and Camptothecin, at the Natural Products Laboratory at RTI International, which goes back several decades. Cedric has had a long and distinguished career working with medicines and agrochemicals from microbes with extensive experience in natural products and their applications. He was awarded a PhD from the University of Southampton in the UK. He was on the faculty at the University of Connecticut School of Pharmacy and spent many years in industry, including stints at Bristol-Myers and American Cyanamid. He moved into biotechnology, including periods with Mycosearch and then OSI Pharmaceuticals. After a period with a life science venture capital firm here in the Triangle, he founded Mycosynthetics in 2001. Cedric has published and lectured extensively on medicines and other products from microorganisms and is the inventor on a number of issued patents. He is also currently an adjunct professor in the chemistry and biochemistry department at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro, where he is also a Coleman Foundation Entrepreneurial Fellow. And we will talk about all of that and more. Cedric Pierce, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you, Ernie.
To begin our discussion, obviously, we want to spend much of our time exploring the wide world of fungi. But we should probably start by defining our terminology. In your mind, exactly what are fungi and where do they fall in the tree of life?
Well, fungi are basically microorganisms, which means you need a microscope to see them mostly. Mm-hmm. They're very small organisms. They're found everywhere. There's at least 1.5 million different species thought to exist in the world, possibly many more than that. They're eukaryotic organisms, which means they're not closely related to bacteria. They're more closely related to us, animals, plants. They require, in the terms of chemistry, they're called organotrophs, which means they need organic carbon to live. They can't fix carbon dioxide as in the same way that plants can. So plants can live with water, CO2, and sunlight and form their own carbon-carbon bonds, but fungi need that. And everybody is aware, I'm sure, of fungi. They've seen them growing on the bread in the fridge that's been left there too long. It's this greeny mold. Mm-hmm. That's a fungus. You'll get black fungi sometimes growing on your wall if you're unlucky. And that anywhere there's organic carbon and water, the fungi will find a way of living there.
So how are fungi, useful in terms of their ability to yield biologically active compounds? I know that we already have drugs and agrochemicals in existence and currently in use that were derived from fungi, correct?
Absolutely. In modern terms, of course, we think penicillin is probably the first real fungal metabolite that entered medicine. Is penicillin G, was produced by a Penicillium species, and that's been known for now for almost 100 years. Mm-hmm. The other thing about penicillin G is it's still a fantastic antibiotic. If you're unfortunate enough to be infected with the right gram-positive bacterium that doesn't make beta-lactamases, then penicillin G is a good antibiotic. It's very potent. It's also very cheap, and so penicillin G now is more or less a commodity chemical at probably $10 a kilogram, something like that, plus minus. But before then, even, people realized that fungi were the health benefits of fungi. And even back in Chinese traditional medicine, there are not many examples, actually, of fungi being used in traditional medicine, except there are a few, and one of them is the use of red yeast rice, which has been around since about 800 AD, according to the records, in China. And this is a Monascus yeast species that is grown on rice, and people use that as a pharmaceutical. And in fact, it's been shown to contain statins like Compactin, which was later discovered by Merck in the 70s and then turned into this whole family of cholesterol-lowering agents. And so that's been around since 800 AD in a traditional medicinal form. So fungi have provided us with a number of medicines, including penicillin G and then other antibiotics. We have cyclosporin, which is used for organ transplant patients. It's an immunosuppressive agent. There are a variety of hallucinogenic compounds from fungi, psilocybin, lysergic acid, which is used for making LSD. More recently, last 2 years ago, a compound called Galenia, which is from a cordyceps fungus, which is derived from a cordyceps metabolite. This compound Galenia was approved for use for multiple sclerosis patients. And so these compounds do have a long span of providing us with pharmaceuticals.
I see. Very good. Well, the point here, I think, is that fungi have the ability to make compounds from their metabolites that do have effects on other organisms. You mentioned penicillin, and apparently there are also herbicides and insecticides derived from fungal metabolites, and I know that that's one of your active areas as well. One of the statistics in doing the research for our conversation that I thought was pretty amazing and bodes well for the future of your company, is that just 5% of those 1.5 million species have actually been described in the literature. So it's a very much under-investigated resource.
Yeah, and if I might add a little bit to that, as you said, there's at least 1.5 million species, probably 80,000 or so have been described in the literature. There's a huge number of the fungi that exist that we haven't looked at yet. And more recently, we have genetic sequencing data that's become available that shows that quite frequently, even known fungi, within their genes, they contain the genes to produce enzymes which will produce compounds that we haven't found yet. And so there, it's this incredible sort of untapped ability of fungi to make compounds. And furthermore, recently too, some cataloging has been done on whether fungi can make, in fact, distinct compounds from each other, and that does appear to be the case. And so, in generalized terms, it seems that a given fungus is able to make three unique compounds. So that means that a lot of fungi will make a lot of compounds that are common. Things like ethanol, for example, is a common metabolite. Actually, statins are relatively common. And then there are the more unusual chemicals that are unique to a given fungus. And so if we then take the 1.5 million species, and they're all making at least three unique compounds, you can see this is a vast library of unusual compounds that we really need to access and test to see if they have any utility for any number of growing problems.
Absolutely. Well, Cedric, as I mentioned in my introduction, you've worked in a variety of areas within the field of natural products. What led you to ultimately come to specialize in fungi?
Well, I think, like a lot of things, it was a sequence of events. And so I actually came to the party, the science party, early. I left school when I was 16, and I worked in a couple of labs, including a hospital lab. And it was in a hospital lab where I learned a lot of skills that were useful later on. And after I'd been in the hospital environment for a while working in the pathology department, I realized that I really liked working in a lab. I really liked science. And that, in fact, I would like to spend the rest of my life doing this if I could. And I was able to secure a place at a university. And I studied biochemistry and physiology at university. And after I had finished my bachelor's degree, I was quite interested in the ability of microorganisms to make chemicals and had an opportunity to work on making new antibiotics with different bacteria. And that more or less led into this experience with fungi. So working with bacteria initially, making new antibiotics, then appreciating fungi for what they were producing, and then working more on fungi. And so currently we just work on fungi, but of course there are many bacteria too that are able to make interesting compounds.
Absolutely, and certainly as we're seeing emerging science with the microbiome, that is certainly telling us a lot about our microbial friends and enemies. So what led you, Cedric, to establish Mycosynthetics? I know we're taking a quick leap forward in time, but you established the company in 2001. And what brought that about? How did you come to establish the company?
It was sort of by chance, but not totally. But I had worked with a local mycologist from UNC, Barry Katz. Barry is a very entrepreneurial man, and he's also a great mycologist. Mm-hmm. And he had for his PhD developed, he was interested in basically carbon cycling, which the idea is that plants can fix CO2 and they make their leaves and twigs, and when they die, it drops off the tree and falls to the bottom of the tree, and through a whole community of microorganisms and animals, that's turned back to carbon dioxide, which gets into the atmosphere, and this is then available for photosynthesis. That's the carbon cycle, basically. Barry was very interested in some of the activities that fungi were taking part in at the base of the tree. That is leaf litter, and he studied the fungi in that community and also worked out ways of isolating some of the more unusual fungi within that community. So not just the spore-forming things that you might find on your bread in the fridge that quickly grow. Mm-hmm. Barry was able to access more unusual, slow-growing fungi. And he started a company called MycoSearch. And MycoSearch provided access to the fungal collection that Barry developed to pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies. And that's really when I first met Barry, when I was working for a company called American Cyanamid that no longer exists. And we actually bought fungi from Barry and used them in our own research. And it quickly became apparent that these were a very unusual set of microorganisms that Barry had in his collection at MycoSearch. And Barry and I got on pretty well, and we had, I think, some good ideas to exploit the culture collection in different ways. And so I basically moved down here to North Carolina to work with Barry at MycoSearch. But shortly after moving, OSI Pharmaceuticals acquired MycoSearch and the culture collection. And Barry and I worked for OSI Pharmaceuticals. Now, this is a different tack entirely, because now OSI Pharmaceuticals was a drug discovery and development company, and they had discovered a new anti-cancer compound. And they wanted to focus their efforts on developing the anti-cancer compound. And so they were no longer really that interested in maintaining the fungus collection. But having worked with it for a number of years by then, I realized the value of it. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be a terrible waste for all this work that Barry had put into it, all this unusual mycology. And then quite obviously the fungi were making interesting compounds. And I had the opportunity to acquire the collection back, which I did. So I acquired the collection back from OSI Pharmaceuticals and established MycoSynthetics. Now, the difference between MycoSynthetics and MycoSearch, MycoSearch was a fungus research company focusing on the fungi. And MycoSynthetics, we're much more interested in the chemistry, actually. And so our efforts, we've not really added to Barry's culture collection, only in a very, very minor way. But we're much more interested in culturing them in different ways and trying to find new biologically active compounds from the fungi. And that's really the difference. Obviously, we have very limited resources because we bootstrapped the company. We've lived on grants and contracts. But that's been our focus, to try to find new chemicals. And I think we have been more and more successful at doing that.
Excellent. Well, how is this collection maintained, Cedric? And how big is a collection of 55,000 fungi? Are we talking about a gigantic warehouse to house it all at minus 80 degrees C? Or how does that work physically?
Yeah, that's a great question, of course. In the wild, the fungi live, and there's nothing particularly fancy about the way they maintain themselves. They just live in whatever nature throws at them, different temperatures, different moisture contents, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The culture collection actually is in about a room about the size of this studio, roughly.
Okay.
So we're not an enormous room. We keep them in tubes, a tube about the size of your finger, and we have about 250,000 tubes in the room. Each tube has given a barcode, and then we have a database, and we're able to interrogate the database and find out the history of each fungus. And of course, Barry started this business a long while ago, and so we can go back 25 years, at least 25 years, and we know what the fungus has been used for, where it was isolated, which substrate it was isolated from, all this kind of natural history of the fungus. Mm-hmm. We have, you're interested, you said we keep them at minus 80. We have kept fungi at minus 80. In our experience, they don't always thrive very well at minus 80. And so what we prefer to do is a bit like painting a very large bridge or something. When you start at one end and you go to the other end, and then you have to go back to the start again. That's kind of what we do with the culture collection. So we start at tube number one, and we go through to tube number 55,000, and then we go back to tube number one, and we make sure it's okay, and we reculture it if necessary. And that's how we maintain it.
I see.
We have viable cultures that Barry isolated from the Amazon more than 25 years ago. So I think we're pretty comfortable with this arrangement. Obviously, once we find a fungus that is very interesting and making an interesting type of compound, we make absolutely certain that we don't lose that fungus. We have multiple tubes, and we keep them in under multiple different conditions.
That makes sense. So how are new metabolites extracted from the collection? Because that's really where the action is, so to speak, isn't it?
Absolutely. We think so. And, of course, we're just carrying on this kind of process that, as I said, Barry started 25 years ago. So we're primarily interested in biologically active compounds. So we know that fungi make great chemists. They make lots of different chemicals. We're not necessarily so interested in that. And I think the thing to remember, and this is basically the single most important point, is that we're interested in fungal metabolites that have some kind of biological activity, such as penicillin, such as cyclosporin, such as the statins. Mm-hmm. So, and to detect that, we use what's called a bioassay, which is a miniaturized biological system, and we take extracts of the fungi that we've grown up in different types of media, and we put them into the little biological system, and we observe the activity. For example, if we're looking for a new herbicide, we may have a tiny well with a few plantlets growing in it, and we put the extract into that and see what effect it has on the plants. And so we're able to do 100 experiments in a space that's about 6 inches by 4 inches.
Mm-hmm. These are the so-called well-known 96 well plates, right?
The well-known 96 well plates, yes.
Ah, so you're really applying pretty state-of-the-art technology to the screening process.
Yes, and one of the things I think that we've been able to do is, first of all, we have the in-house kind of activities. The herbicide activity that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. We're very interested in new antibiotics. It's easy for us to work with microorganisms because we have those skills. Now, we've worked on other projects. For example, for a number of years, we worked with in a project funded by Medicines for Malaria Venture, trying to find new anti-malarial compounds from our fungi. And we grew all 55,000 of our fungi and prepared extracts. And these were tested in against the actual malaria parasite in cell culture at the University of South Florida. And so we were able to, through a collaboration, identify fungal metabolites that had potential anti-malarial activity. And this work is still going on. We've found some very interesting compounds. We've applied for patents on some of them. And as I said, this work is going on. We've worked for a number of years on cancer, and you, of course, have spoken to a number of the people here, Nick Obelis, David Kroll, mm-hmm. Munsak Wani. We work together using our fungi and their expertise in cancer research to try and find new anti-cancer compounds from our fungi.
Sure.
We're very keen on this. We've done this for a number of years. I think we've identified about 200 fungal metabolites with potent cytotoxicity activity, which is sometimes an indicator of anti-cancer activity.
Mm-hmm. Cell killing.
Cell killing, yes, thank you. And about a quarter of them are new compounds, so they haven't been evaluated, as far as we're aware, by anybody else. And this work is still going on. It's funded by the National Cancer Institute. Mm-hmm. And as I said, we've been doing it for a number of years.
So it's entirely possible that the next Taxol or Camptothecin may be sitting there in that collection somewhere.
I think you're right. It is entirely possible. Obviously, we can't be certain. But if we use the same techniques that Munsak Wani and Munro Wall used, which is using a biological activity-guided sort of process, mm-hmm. it's quite possible that we will find new compounds, and we do actually have some quite exciting things that we're working on now, and these are being evaluated by a number of groups, including at the University of Illinois, the Ohio State University, and in Georgia. So, you know, we make sure that these compounds get a lot of exposure.
I see. Well, Cedric, I want to come back and hear more about the library itself and about mycosynthetics, but I'd like to widen our discussion out just for a bit first. It seems like the drug discovery methods that were in vogue in the 90s and 2000s, things such as combinatorial chemistry, so-called rational drug design, computational chemistry and such, that those methods have seemed to have ultimately yielded disappointing results. In your mind, is the industry now starting to return to more active exploration of natural products such as fungi for development and discovery of lead compounds?
Yeah, you raise some interesting points. I think especially the issue of combinatorial chemistry, which was a way of making large numbers of compounds quickly and simply, and there was a lot of activity in the 90s about this. And I think up until then, really, in a way, using natural products was a kind of a combinatorial chemistry approach, because you'd make an extract of a fungus or an extract of a bacteria, and there would be maybe 1,000 or 2,000 different compounds in there. And of course, the big difference was with the combinatorial chemistry, it was relatively straightforward to work out which were the active compounds, if indeed there were any, whereas with the natural products, the deconvolution is a lot more complicated. So, and of course, I think pretty much every major pharmaceutical company jumped on combinatorial chemistry as the way of making large numbers of compounds. And of course, unfortunately, what happened in a large number of cases were large numbers of useless compounds were made, because they were driven by chemistry and not by necessarily biology. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's come a long way since those early days. I'm not aware of anything that was discovered through any drug that was discovered through combinatorial chemistry as such. And I'd be really happy if any of your listeners know something different, but I'm not aware of a single one. But anyway, it was what you would call more or less a disruptive technology, because it came along and it more or less replaced all the natural products research that was going on. Now, coming full cycle, as you know, I'm an editor for the Journal of Natural Products, and I see a lot of manuscripts on different natural products, and a lot of them do have startling activities still, even today, after years and years of research. And the modern chemistry, where we're able to work out structures of compounds and purify compounds on a very, very small amount of material, has really, I think, enabled modern natural products research to move ahead. And coupled too with the 96 well plate and the 384 well plate mm-hmm. approach, where you can test large numbers of compounds for activity, I think these new technologies really should enable a better exploration of the natural products from plants and bacteria and fungi, and even to the point where we go back and look at some of the old plants and fungi that we've looked at in the past.
Sure. Take a second look with the new technology, right?
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm.
That's going to be fascinating to watch as things progress. Well, it sounds, Cedric, like a company like yours is ideally situated strategically at this point. It sounds like you have a lot to offer and should be getting a lot of interest.
Well, I'd like to think so. You know, we've worked with a number of different companies. We collaborate with a lot of different universities and research institutes. We've had funding from USDA, National Institutes of Health, as I mentioned, Medicines for Malaria Venture, National Cancer Institute. Mm-hmm. And we've looked at our fungi for a wide variety of compounds or activities, including enzymes. And we had a project with BP Biofuels to look at fungi for their ability to decompose cellulose, for example, as a way to making ethanol from woody material rather than corn. That's obviously an entirely different discussion from the one we're having up until now, but it gives you an example of how our fungi have been used.
Sure, and I want to come back to that, actually. I have a question prepared for you a little bit later about that. But I would like to give our listeners a flavor for how your library of fungi can be used to actual effect. So I'd like to spend a little time talking in some detail about one of your success stories, the natural herbicide called mevalosidin. And I think I pronounced that correctly right off the bat.
Yes, you did.
Very good. Now, I understand that it's a product of metabolites from two fungi, which are unique to the Mycosynthetics collection.
That's correct. We discovered this in a collaboration with Dow AgroSciences in Indianapolis. They looked at probably 15,000 or so of our fungi for different activities, including herbicide activity. And because of the relationship we had with Dow, we had the ability to acquire certain intellectual property, and in this case, mevlocidin. Dow looked at it, and it didn't necessarily fit the big agricultural portfolio, whereas for a relatively small biotech-oriented company, where a possible market of 50 or 75 million year product was still attractive, and that's not necessarily attractive for a large company, or at least it wasn't then. Mm-hmm. So we had two fungi that make this compound mevlocidin, and more recently, in fact, in the last couple of months, we've actually found through genetic analysis that these may actually be the same organism. And not only that, they are in a group of fungi that are relatively rare, which actually makes sense, because mevlocidin is a low molecular weight compound. It's a small, simple chemical, and it's unique. And so it's unusual to find a small compound that hasn't been published or described before. Mevlocidin is basically seven carbons. It is a small compound. So the fact that it came from an unusual fungus makes more sense to us now. Now, it's widely active against a variety of different weeds. Dow actually were able to synthesize the compound and test the synthetic material, but we're not necessarily interested in that. We want to use the natural compound. In fact, we're developing an inexpensive fungus fermentation product that can be applied directly as a herbicide. It, as I said, it has a broad spectrum of activity. It's active against a variety of different pests, including pigweed, which is a hell of a problem with cotton farmers. Mm-hmm. It's becoming Roundup resistant. And we were lucky enough to obtain funding from the USDA with a so-called Phase 1 SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research Grant, last year, and developed the fermentation to a point where we're able to improve the yield of the active component 250-fold. And so now we're able to...
And that was one of the big challenges, wasn't it?
Oh, thank you.
Being able to scale up like that.
That's exactly right. The initial productivity was vanishingly small, and that was one of the reasons, I think, that other firms pulled back from it, because it was technically difficult. But, of course, we grow fungi all the time. That's our business. You know, we probably culture 50,000 different fungi a year.
You're like Fungi R Us, right?
Fungi R Us, that's correct. And so we've developed lots of tricks in the lab to growing fungi, and we were able to apply some of these relatively straightforward tricks to this fungus, both fungi actually, that make this material, and improve the yield. This was in working collaboration with Professor Obeles at UNCG. He did a lot of the chemistry work for us, so that's how we're able to know exactly how the yield has improved. But we think that we don't have to use the chemical at all. We're going to use a fungus fermentation material that we're going to grow simply, and that is going to be applied as the herbicide.
I see. So let me make sure I'm following you correctly here. You're going to be actually deriving the herbicide itself from the fungi themselves, not attempting the intermediate step of synthesizing the chemical.
That's absolutely correct. And so this way, it's going to be classified as a biopesticide.
Mm-hmm.
It's a completely natural product. It's from a fungus that's not pathogenic to plants. And so the unusual thing about this is the EPA regulates biopesticides in a different way than it regulates synthetic chemicals. And so it's relatively straightforward. Of course, it has to be tested for its activity against animals, honeybees, the type of things that it would see in the environment. It has to be tested and made sure that it's not going to be harmful to those organisms. But basically, it's a relatively straightforward process. It will take us, we anticipate, within 2 years, we might have a product that we're able to sell.
I see. That was actually my next question about where you stand in terms of the commercial development. So the marketplace for mevlocidin is likely to be actually the organic farming community, I take it.
That's right. And it's very interesting because organic farming and no-till farming, at the moment, they really don't have any decent options. Now, things like vinegar, acetic acid, you can use vinegar to kill weeds. It's basically just simply burns the plant. It's just simply acidic. And there are some other citrus oil derivatives that can be used. But really, none of them are what you would consider herbicidal. They kill plants, but not in a systemic way. So the competition for mevlocidin is really somebody with a hoe in organic farming. So we're going to actually develop this for organic farming, mm-hmm. and we think that it's going to be a very innovative product, and we certainly hope we can help organic farmers in this way.
Absolutely. Well, it's going to be very exciting to watch that develop. It's almost oxymoronic that there's a herbicide for use in organic farming, but what a wonderful innovation that will be for those folks. It sounds like there's a real need there that this natural product will be able to help fill.
Well, we certainly hope so, and as I said, it's quite potent. It has broad activity against a variety of different weeds. We hope over the next 2 years to be able to complete the field trials and all the other testing that we need to do. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's contingent upon obtaining funding from various places to be able to afford to do the work. But we're very excited about it. I think we've really addressed the one big issue that we were concerned about, and of course that was the productivity of the fungus, which we've improved, and we still think we can improve it even more.
So you say it may be commercially available within a couple of years if all goes well. How will you evolve your company to actually enter into the business of selling? Will you establish a sales force? How will that work?
Yeah, that's very, very interesting question.
That's many biotech startups face at some point in their development, right?
Absolutely. And you know, I teach entrepreneurship in sciences at the university in Greensboro. And this is the sort of thing we talk about. You know, mm-hmm. what do you do? Because we're scientists, and our sweet spot, if you like, is working in the lab discovering things. Our sweet spot is not developing a sales force. And so realistically, I think what we need to do is try to address the technical problems, the yield, how we're going to formulate it finally, these kind of things. We address those. We need to collaborate with weed scientists. We need to collaborate with toxicologists to work out the other parameters. But at some point, we're going to have to partner with somebody who has an in-place sales force. I don't think, you know, never say never, right? But I don't really imagine that Mycosynthetics would turn into a company that sells bags of herbicide, mm-hmm. you know, in Home Depot, for example.
Right, sure. Yeah. So hard to envision a bunch of people traveling the country with carrying the bag for Mycosynthetics as such.
That's correct. I think we need to leverage where we are, sure. with the expertise of companies who are more familiar with that sort of territory.
Indeed. Well, that makes perfect sense, as so many biotech startups do end up going that route and you know, leveraging the expertise they have and maximizing it, and then handing that commercial function off to others who specialize in that kind of activity.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Cedric, I know that there's a lot more going on at Mycosynthetics than just the one product we've been discussing. And you've touched on some of this already, but I want to bring you back to give you the opportunity to tell us more about some of the other research and development programs that are in progress at the company and exploiting this tremendous library of fungi.
Well, apart from mevlocidin, of course, we are interested enormously in this whole area of biopesticides. We have fungi that are insecticidal, fungicidal too. And so we can imagine that we could do a parallel kind of development program with insecticides and fungicides in the same way that we're working on mevalocidin. So that's the first thing that we're thinking about doing. Now, we also are very interested in developing bioassays, ways of detecting activity within the fungi. We've done this through collaborations, but we've also done a number of things in-house. For example, we've worked on parasitic worms, and we've also found a number of fungi that are producing activity against parasitic worms. Now, these are worms that are really responsible for, in some ways, what are referred to as neglected tropical diseases, and also responsible, of course, for infections in animals. And they're largely ignored by a lot of pharmaceutical companies and a lot of agrochemical companies. But we've developed in-house expertise in this. And at the moment, I mean, we're in this discovery phase, but we have found some very potent fungal metabolites that do kill these worms with, as I say, very high potency.
Well, I'm sure there's a gigantic need for an effective product in that area. And these are parasitic worms known as helminths, is that correct?
That's correct. So we have the helminths that live in soil. And then, of course, they're also the same type of worms that infect sheep, for example. And then, yes, that's
okay. Right. Well, I promised we'd come back to this. In terms of using fungi to aid breakdown of cellulose to provide biofuel feedstocks, now this is potentially a huge development. Is that something that is on the horizon with the mycosynthetics collection?
Yeah, so there's been, of course, a lot of work done in this area for a number of years, but basically plant material, cellulose, is sugar units joined together. And if you can break that down so that you have single sugar units, monosaccharides, then you can convert single sugar units into ethanol, for example, or butanol, mm-hmm. any number of potential liquid fuels. And currently, of course, we're using cornstarch, which is relatively easy to degrade, to ethanol. You can convert cellulose, which is the woody material that tables and et cetera are made of course, cellulose into simple sugars using acid and heat. It's environmentally unfriendly, but fungi have the ability to decompose cellulose also. And how do I know that? Because I told you that fungi have to have organic carbon, and fungi decompose plant material, right? Because you've all seen rotten wood.
That's what they do.
That's how they live. So we're not really asking them to do anything outrageous here. This is what they do.
Right.
They decompose wood. They decompose wood, and they take the cellulose, and they convert it to simple sugars, and then they use the simple sugars for their metabolism. Now, the other thing to remember is that ethanol is a fungus product. It's made by yeast. A yeast is a fungus. So what we were really hoping we would be able to do is take a fungus that would live on the wood and then produce ethanol. So the so-called consolidated process, which would technically make it easy, because we're thinking of making a product that's going to be about $2 a gallon or whatever. So it's not particularly an expensive product, and so we need a simple process. So what have we done in this area? We had a long collaboration with BP Biofuels, looking at fungi that would make cellulases, and we had different types of cellulase assays running in the lab. And we frankly found fungi that were very active with producing cellulases. We haven't really done any more. We haven't worked on this project probably for a year because we've been focusing on other things. But yeah, so that was our interest.
I see. Well, I would hope to see a partnership maybe with the North Carolina Biofuels Center at some point. And I know that you're well acquainted with the Biotechnology Center as well. So it'll be interesting to see where that one goes. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Cedric Pierce, founder and CEO of Mycosynthetics, a biotech company specializing in fungi that is based in Hillsboro, just like yours truly. Cedric, I did want to devote at least some of our remaining time together today to learning more about your entrepreneurial activities, which you did allude to. You certainly have a rich background in both science and business. So where did this proclivity come from? Did it start with the year you spent with the life science venture capitalist firm led by Art Pappas?
Yeah, it was slow kind of awakening, I guess, really. First of all, I think when I worked with Barry Katz years ago, Barry was a great entrepreneur, and I learned a great deal from Barry and also from the CEO of OSI Pharmaceuticals, Colin Goddard, who also was very entrepreneurial. And up until that point, I really had focused on science. I was interested in making discoveries and publishing papers. But after I had met Barry Katz and Colin Goddard, and then spent a year with Art Pappas, when I came across a large number of entrepreneurs, I became very, very enamored with the idea that scientists are constantly exposed to new ideas, and they should be able to develop some of those ideas for the benefit of society. So I had the opportunity to acquire the Culture Collection. I mean, it wasn't a huge risk, if you like, because I already knew it was valuable. And we quickly developed some relationships which funded the activity. But subsequent to then, I've maintained this kind of active interest in the idea that traditional scientists, with a few exceptions, don't really make good entrepreneurs. And they should do. And the reason they should do is because they're constantly exposed to new ideas. They're constantly discovering new ideas and developing new processes and products. But for some reason, there's the gap between the discovery and turning things into products. Like I said, there are notable examples, and we have them here in the park, and through history that there have been. But why can't ordinary PhD students, for example, they're exposed to novel ideas, why can't they, have an idea, write a grant proposal, start a company too? And especially in the environment where it is difficult, frankly, for everybody to find a permanent position. So,
sure. So
that's really where I'm coming from. I've taught entrepreneurship to scientists for a number of years. I've been lucky enough to teach it at UNC in Greensboro for the last 3 years, where also I'm a Coleman Foundation Fellow. They've funded a little bit of my activities, and so that's been good.
I wanted to ask you about that as well. You're a Coleman Entrepreneurial Fellow. What is that distinction about?
So the Coleman Foundation, they are an organization in Chicago, and they are very interested in developing entrepreneurship. Their interpretation of entrepreneurship is more or less the ability to be self-employed. So they have a very specific goal, and of course, entrepreneurship has lots of different interpretations depending upon who you speak to. But the Coleman Foundation is very focused on this. They want to enable people to secure self-employment. They have funded a number of fellows. I was a fellow 3 years ago, and then subsequently I stayed associated with the foundation. We meet frequently over the internet, of course. We meet frequently. We talk about what people are trying to do, what courses are being developed, and we swap ideas about how we can teach entrepreneurship in different areas. It's a kind of cross-campus activity, so it's not necessarily solely in the business school. This is now like in arts department and chemistry departments and this kind of thing, and engineering departments. And as I said, again, to reiterate, the idea is that we try to make a certain percentage of the students aware that they have the ability to maybe start their own businesses, start their own companies, and become independent and develop things for the good of society. And so that's really where it's coming from.
I see. Very good. Well, you are certainly a shining example of that very philosophy. I noticed that you've also authored a chapter in a textbook on biotechnology entrepreneurship, a 2009 book titled Industry Immersion Learning, Real-Life Industry Case Studies in Biotechnology and Business. And your chapter was called Entrepreneurship, Establishing a New Biotechnology Venture. So what were some of the learned lessons that you were able to impart to your readers in that thing where you literally wrote the book on biotech entrepreneurship?
Well, you know, one of the things that really excited me, if you like, was the chance to be able to interact with science students and to talk to them about exploiting biotechnology ideas. I've broadened that out, of course, since then. But when I wrote the chapter, I had had a number of classes working at NC State in Raleigh in the biotechnology program, where we more or less took student ideas, and in the classroom environment, we kind of did the things that you would ordinarily do to try to develop a company. Now, the thing that was really very interesting was the students had great ideas. They were master's level students, and they brought great ideas to the table. And it was quite eye-opening to see the quality of the ideas. And I'm sure from every class I took, some of those ideas in the right hands could have been turned into viable companies. And I was kind of surprised. I thought the student ideas might be a little bit more naive, but they weren't. They were very savvy. We had all kinds of things, like somebody wanted to develop a small fermenter that would be in a commercial kitchen to convert kitchen waste into methane that would be used for cooking. Another student from Brazil wanted to engineer sugarcane so that we could grow it in North Carolina. The ethanol industry in Brazil is run on sugarcane. We can't grow sugarcane here because the environment is not correct, but if we could, it would be great. Somebody else wanted to genetically engineer peanuts so that the antigen in peanuts that is an allergic issue wouldn't be present. Mm-hmm. Just from master's levels, you know, just great, great ideas. So that was exciting. And I must say, in the five times I have taught this class at different universities, that is a common theme. The student ideas, you know, are just great. And so it's very encouraging. Now we've got, the students have got great ideas. If we can somehow show them how to turn those ideas into viable businesses, I think, you know, that's a great advance. Yeah.
Well, that's terrific. Well, Cedric, it's been a great hour and such a pleasure to get to know you and hear more about the exciting work that you're doing in the world of natural products and fungi. So we'll see you around Hillsboro. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Ernie. I enjoyed it a lot.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming guests. We are on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date like that. Join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we do ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. Now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Catch you next time. Thanks for listening. By pressing down the special key.